Well, we open up this show with a song by Bob Dylan, Man Gave Names to All the Animals, and some clever lines in there. That's from his Slow Train Coming, Bob Dylan. You're listening to KDRT 95.7 in Davis, California. I'm your host, Peter Pastor, and I'm going to be with you the whole hour here. And if you're a regular listener, you just know, that I usually interview musicians, and there is no difference this time around. Except this time we're going to talk to a musician But he's going to talk about a book he wrote and what he plans to do for a living. And I'd like to welcome Jacob Johnson. Welcome.
Hey, thanks so much. Great to be here.
I'm really glad you're back. You were here maybe 6, 8, 9 months ago, I forget, maybe even a year by now, as one of the Cowboys After Dark.
Yeah, that's right.
A group that you were involved in, maybe still are.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Good. Yeah. Well, in the background, we got some birds going.
Oh, yeah.
So we're going to pretend we're out in the field. We're going to talk to you about all these things. I'm just going to start off by saying that a study conducted by the Scottish SPCA and the University of Glasgow suggests that dogs prefer reggae and soft music over any other kind. They did a study on this.
Yeah.
I would love to explore, like, do animals really hear music?
Well, that's
and we don't need to go there, but
yeah.
It'd be kind of interesting to know, because especially pets are surrounded by TV and stereo and that. Do they actually hear something that we hear, or
yeah.
is it just background noise?
Yeah, what a great question, one that has not kind of reached any kind of scientific consensus yet. But I'll say this, you know, the species that I study for my PhD in animal behavior are birds. I focus on birds. I do research on a species that lives in the Sacramento area called the Black Phoebe, and another bird that winters here in the greater Sacramento area and then migrates up to mountains to breed called the Dark-Eyed Junco. And so, you know, one parallel we can make right off the bat between humans and other animals is many animals have, like us, very deeply complex systems of vocalization, of listening and repeating.
Right.
So, you know, to your point of do animals prefer music, or can they even conceptualize music? There is some evidence to that.
Okay.
If you've ever heard of Snowball the Dancing Cockatoo, I'd recommend Googling it, because there are videos online of parrots and parakeets bobbing their heads and dancing in rhythm to the Backstreet Boys, to Queen. They appear to have some concept.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Some concept of rhythm. Now, does that mean that they are interpreting music the same way we are? No, but I am curious, because, so when we learn to talk, we kind of go through this phase where we're babbling, we're listening to what our parents, the people around us, are saying, and we're starting to string things together.
Right.
And animals, many animals, like songbirds, like whales, have a very similar parallel system for learning their songs. So I wonder if there's some connection there.
I'm sure there is.
Yeah.
I'm sure there is. Interesting. Well, we're going to spend the whole hour playing some music, you know, some songs that you might know or might not know.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, down the line, the only one I could find that was very popular at one time, that was Talk to the Animals.
Mm-hmm.
You remember that song?
I don't think I do.
Talk to the Animals. So anyways, the song goes on talking to different kinds of animals.
Yeah.
So we'll get into a few of that. But let's just start with you. How did you get involved in the field of study that you're doing?
So
was there a point in your childhood that said, that was like an aha moment that, this is what I want to do?
So I've always had a really huge interest in wildlife and in science.
Right.
My parents would take me to the Natural History Museum and to the zoo all the time. And I remember from very early on being fascinated by animals. But interestingly, I kind of got into the study of bird research through my music experience. What I mean by that is, you know, I grew up taking jazz lessons. I you know, kind of started to develop an ear for playing things by ear.
Right.
And I was doing this work at a golf course in my hometown, focusing on trying to identify all the different bird species that were at this golf course. And one of the things I realized is that the ear training that I used to memorize, you know, different patterns of music could also be applied to memorizing birdsong. And that was a light bulb moment for me because, and I remembered the change because it goes from hearing birds vocalizing and singing as just kind of idle background noise.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, once you start to learn what these vocalizations all mean, it becomes this cacophony of information. You know, you can hear the family of blue jays near your house fighting with each other.
You can
hear the red-winged blackbirds calling for a mate. Like, there are all of these details about the environment that all of a sudden start springing into your head. And so I kind of got there from my music background, I'd say.
Well, I can sort of understand that. I've had dogs. And all of my married life, we've had dogs or a cat. And like now we have a cat. I can understand basically the different sounds the cat makes, what it means.
Mm-hmm.
That's because he has trained me, you know. I know when he's got a live animal in his mouth, that a certain sound comes out. Mm-hmm. I know when he does certain things, he's happy. I didn't understand that if you study, let's say, a particular bird, you can also hear those things.
Oh, yes.
Really?
Oh, yeah. So birds have very distinct patterns of vocalizations. In the science world, we distinguish between something called a song and a call. So a song has a specific function. It's a bird sings either to attract a mate, to defend a territory that it's holding onto, or sometimes both at the same time. And some songs are actually different depending on what they're purposes. Like, for example, one of the birds I study, they have this very loud trill sound they make when they're defending their territories.
Okay.
But when they're courting a female, they will get right up to her and they will sing this very quiet, very complex song.
Whoa.
Right only to her. Only this very short, complex piece of song. So, And calls, they have distinct calls that mean different kinds of predators are around. They have calls that they make when they contact one another. When they see if they're paired up, many birds have contact calls that specifically mean that, you know, they've arrived at the nest.
Right.
So there are all these different vocalizations in the bird world. Very, very chatty animals.
Wow. First of all, you said they're trying to attract a mate. That was one of the reasons for bird singing, right?
Right.
So I heard someone say this, and I've always thought of it since then. When you're somewhere in town, and all of a sudden a car comes by just blasting loud music, right? I keep telling the people around me, it's usually a he. He's looking for a mate. Sort of a similar thing, isn't it?
Well, you know, Charles Darwin had one of his initial ideas when he was trying to figure out, you know, where human speech comes from.
He
was thinking maybe even before we spoke, we sang. And maybe, maybe between both sexes, we had this system of singing as a way to show our fitness, right? Maybe
that's amazing.
It was one of his ideas. Yeah.
Wow. Okay, you're blowing my mind here. Okay, so that's what got you going into it. Then you went to high school, you went to college, and now you're in postgrad, right? Or studying for your PhD.
Right.
And are you going into a certain specific field now? If I might ask what that is.
Yeah. Well, I'm kind of at the stage where I'm writing up my dissertation. Finished all of kind of the grunt work for my PhD research. And now I'm just trying to get that into dissertation form. And from there, I kind of have some options for what I want to pursue afterward.
Okay.
One option for me would be pursuing something like a teaching professorship, which kind of focuses more on teaching things in ecology and evolution. I could go for what's called a postdoctoral researcher position or a postdoc. That's where the emphasis is usually a little bit more on research.
Right.
So it's sort of a postdoc is kind of like this intermediary step for many academics between grad student and professor.
Good, good. Mm-hmm. Okay. You're listening to KDRT. We are a quarter of the way through the show. Let's collect our thoughts here and listen to what happens when people talk to the animals.
Imagine it, chatting with a chimp and chimpanzee. Imagine talking to a tiger, chatting with a cheetah. What a neat achievement it would be. If we could talk to the animals, learn their languages, maybe take an animal degree. We'd study elephant and eagle, buffalo and beagle, alligator, guinea pig and flea. We would converse in polar bear and python, and we would curse in fluent kangaroo. If people asked us, can you speak a rhinoceros? We'd say, of course, us. Can't you? If we conferred with our furry friends, man to animal, think of all the things we could discuss. If we could walk with the animals, talk with the animals, grunt and squeak and squawk with the animals, and they could talk to us. If we consulted with quadrupeds, think what fun we'd have asking over crocodiles for tea. Or maybe lunch with two or three lions, walruses and sea lions. What a lovely place the world would be. We'd learn to speak in antelope and turtle. Our Pekingese would be extremely good. If we were asked to sing in hippopotamus, we'd say why anonymous? And would. And I am sure every octopus, place and platypus certainly would see it as a plus. If we could walk with those animals, talk with those animals, grunt and squeak and squawk with those animals, and they could talk to us. We'd study every living creature's language so we could speak to all of them on sight. If friends said, can you talk in crab or pelican? We'd say like hell we can. And we'd be right. And if we all spoke like animals, who needs English? Gradually we'd drop it with no fuss. If we could walk with the animals, talk with the animals, grunt and squeak and squawk with the animals. And they could squeak and squawk and speak and talk to us.
Well, we had a little bumpy start to that song, but Talk to the Animals, that was made famous by, I forget who, but not this person, Sammy Davis Jr.
Oh.
Yeah.
He made it big, or made it into a fairly well-known song.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sitting here talking with Jacob Johnson, and he is not only the saxophone player for a local group here, Cowboys After Dark, but he's also a PhD candidate for animal behavior in the graduate group.
Mm-hmm.
And at UC Davis here, University of California, Davis. And lo and behold, Jacob brought in a book that is going to be released here February 11th.
That's right.
Tell me the name of the book.
The name of the book is Are You There, God? It's Me, Darwin. And it is a sort of a like pop science genre book. So science written in a way that's hopefully going to be accessible to wide audiences.
Oh.
And yeah, it's coming out February 11th.
So that reminded me of a good friend, Ed, who's a vet, right? A veterinarian. He said, and he's owned a lot of animals. And he said the one thing he hopes, if there is a life after death, and he really hopes there is, that the dogs and animals he's had in his house are waiting for him, because he'd love to talk to them, how they saw him, how they saw how he treated him. Just some feedback, you know?
Yeah.
And your title sort of suggests that, well, okay, you know. I don't think Darwin believed in God, though, did he?
So this is actually one of the main things we cover in the book, which is that history has painted Charles Darwin as an atheist.
Yes.
But that is not true.
Oh, okay.
Charles Darwin was, in fact, and very few people know this, Charles Darwin was both trained by and in training to become an Anglican priest.
Holy cow.
So, and you know, Charles Darwin, at the end of his life, yeah, he was kind of an agnostic. But even at the end of his life, I would argue that he still spoke in terms of kind of a dispassionate, law-giving God.
Right.
Just not one that intervened in the physical world. People call that a deist.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, no, there's this big misconception, yeah. I think. And I think it's actually really contributed to the divisions that exist in the United States between people, religious groups, and scientific institutions.
Right.
This misconception that science is inherently atheistic. And one of the arguments I make many times in this book is, it is not. Charles Darwin was not an atheist. Science does not have to preclude your religious beliefs. And it's really, really important, actually, that people of faith, people who are interested in science, work together and are able to reconcile and confront these much larger issues that our planet is facing today.
Well, I'm just thinking that thousands of years ago, let's make it hundreds of years ago, when Christianity was already in full blossom, if we didn't understand something, like, for instance, we are the center of the universe, and that's the way God made it, and everybody believed that, until science proved that, wait a minute, maybe God didn't create it that way. Maybe we are circling around a sun. And then later on, we find out that the sun is circling around something else. But it just seems to me that if we don't understand something, some people will automatically say that's God. Mm-hmm. And I think what you're saying is it could be, it could not be, but science has to figure out what's going on. That's your job as a scientist, right?
I suppose so. And now I also want to point out that there are a lot of things that science does really well, like tell you how the universe works. In fact, you know, the people that Charles Darwin learned from, you know, they called themselves natural theologists. Their whole goal was to try to understand how God went out into the universe and laid down the foundations for all of these, you know, wonderful things that exist,
right.
How the universe works. And science is really good at getting to the how it works part.
Okay.
But I'll say that science is not always, you know, science is not meant to get us to the fundamental why, like why do we care?
Right,
you know,
right.
What is the meaning of all of this,
right.
You know? So these questions that science can't answer are often answerable by philosophy or
right.
religion.
Yes,
and, you know,
yes.
Both have important things to tell us about our universe.
Right. Okay, in your book, just briefly, let's go through it. You start off with saying, are you listening, God? So that implies something, but how does the book start and how does it evolve and what exactly are you trying to teach people?
Yeah.
And what you're saying is in a non-scientific language.
Yeah,
right.
I think that's right. So
right.
This book is fundamentally about the evolution of our sense of good and evil, of right and wrong. And it's sort of paralleled. The story is told kind of in parallel of Charles Darwin's own kind of crisis of faith that happens to him both on the, you know, during his Beagle voyage while he's writing The Origin of Species and The Descent of Man and later on, and how, you know, Darwin reconciles with our human sense of morality, and then what modern examples in the animal kingdom have to tell us about where our own sense of right and wrong comes from.
Okay, so now this is interesting to me. You're studying animals, but you're also saying animals can teach us right and wrong?
Absolutely, or at least where, like the...
Where it came from.
Yes, yeah.
Give me an example.
Sure. So one of the examples I give in this book is capuchin monkeys.
Right.
And so scientists have studied capuchin monkeys and discovered that they appear to have a sense of fairness.
Okay.
So what that means is there's this study that was done. Researchers trained capuchin monkeys to perform a simple task. I think it was to, like, give researchers a pebble. And in reward for giving the researchers a pebble, they would all be given a cucumber. And then, so capuchins like cucumbers.
Yeah, yeah.
But then the scientists started giving one of the capuchins a grape instead of a cucumber. Capuchins love grapes. And what started to happen was that when the other capuchins who were getting a cucumber as a reward saw their fellow capuchin getting a grape instead, there's a video of them throwing the cucumber back at the researchers, getting angry. And this also exists. This has been shown in chimpanzees and I think perhaps some other primates. But it's really interesting. They seem to have this sense that, you know, that's not fair.
Yeah,
they're getting a better reward than me.
Wait a minute. Are you telling me these monkeys are socialists? Come on.
Or that fairness is an inherent concept in the animal kingdom.
Exactly.
So another great example, vampire bats, actually, of all animals. So vampire bats, you know, they kind of get a bad rap. They you know, have to go out and bite typically mammals. They'll drink their blood.
Right.
But the problem with being a vampire bat is that you don't always have a successful night. And since you only eat blood, that's not really good for kind of packing on a lot of calories. So you can easily starve.
Oh.
And so what vampire bats do is they share with one another. If a vampire bat gets a really good meal, one of their friends or relatives who has not eaten that night will ask for food. And the vampire bat will share some of that food they got. But here's the kicker. Typically speaking, that vampire bat expects that when the situation is reversed, you are going to share with them. And vampire bats, as it's been shown, keep careful track of their social circles and who is sharing with who and, you know, who is in debt, you know, to who. I talk a lot about kin selection, where animals will make sacrifices for their young. I talk about reciprocity, you know, giving something in exchange. Treating others the way you'd like to be treated,
Know,
and all these different examples in the animal kingdom, even in plants, that show these incredibly complex systems that exist not just in humans, but in the entirety of our biosphere.
You know, Jacob, if I were a student in this subject, I would love to have you as a teacher. Your enthusiasm and your articulation of this subject is just... mind-boggling.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, very, very interesting.
Oh, thank you so much.
So, and of course, we see videos of cats sharing things with dogs,
mm-hmm.
or a cat and a horse or something. It's what do they call that, interspecies relationship?
Absolutely.
You know, you see that, and it's, I think if you live on a farm, you probably see it more than most people do.
Definitely. In fact, you know, I was thinking about what you said about your friend wanting, you know, to see their dogs in heaven.
Right.
And how profoundly special is it that our species forms such deep connections with organisms that are not even members of our own species?
Right.
I mean, if you ask me, like I write about this in the book, I think that is the most wonderful thing about humans is our ability to extend our empathy, our sense of belonging, of kin, to these other species like dogs, horses, you know, many, many other animals. I mean, it's been essential for our development as a species.
Right. Are you a vegetarian?
I knew I was going to get asked this question.
Right.
I try to eat less meat.
Yes.
Okay. I typically avoid eating meat when I can.
Right.
I do eat a little bit of meat.
No, but I see cows as very loving animals, very inquisitive animals.
Mm-hmm.
Pigs are a lot like a dog almost. And yet when I see how they're treated for us to get our Big Mac, it's a big turnoff, really.
Yeah.
But anyways, we're going to take a short break here. I'm going to play a song by Sting. You know Sting?
Oh, yeah.
It's called Fragile, because the world we live in, you're talking about all these animals. Every year we lose a few. We're living in a fragile world,
mm-hmm.
right? So I'm going to play a song by Sting called Fragile while I do some homework. Okay? Here we go. Thank you. And that, of course, is Sting singing a song he wrote called Fragile. Mm-hmm. And we played that because we're talking with Jacob Johnson here. He is an animal behavior graduate group student, PhD candidate. And we're talking about a new book that he just released called Are You There, God? It's Me, Darwin. And I've already found out something at the very beginning of this show, that Darwin was not really an atheist.
Right. Not okay. An atheist.
So we're learning stuff. We're learning stuff. All righty. We were talking about your book. It's going to be released in 2 weeks now,
mm-hmm.
or thereabouts. You're scheduling maybe some readings, but nothing has happened yet.
Right.
What is actually the goal of this book? Just to get the word out about the subject at hand?
Yeah. One of the things I was really thinking about in this book was finding common ground and finding a way to bring together people who fundamentally care about life on our planet, whether those people are religious, whether those people are not religious and are very kind of scientifically minded,
right.
without religion in their lives, and try to start a dialogue with a very wide group of people who I actually think agree on a lot when it comes to what needs to be done to preserve wildlife,
right.
on our planet.
Right. Yeah, and you think about it, okay, there might be a very obscure little minnow swimming somewhere,
mm-hmm.
and we can't build a dam because of it, whatever it is, whatever the story is. But you have to remember that little minnow took millions of years to become what it is.
Yes, did everything on this planet. Billions of years.
Billions of years, yeah. Including us.
Including us.
Wow, okay, that's... And we might be the last ones left if we keep going the way we are.
Well, you know, humans evolves in a very unique set of environmental circumstances. And like I said earlier, we are so interdependent with so many other species on our, you know, greater well-being and survival as a species. So if the biosphere goes, we go. So it's, we have a vested interest in preserving biodiversity on our planet. That's for sure.
I have this completely different subject, but now, are birds really that they used to be dinosaurs?
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, come on. Really? Little bird?
Yeah. Wow. So birds are, you know, there used to be a lot more different kinds of dinosaurs.
Right.
Birds are just kind of the one branch on the dinosaur tree that made it through the Cretaceous mass extinction some 65-odd million years ago.
Right.
And they hung in there, you know, despite going through this period of terrible climate upheaval.
Right.
You know, they managed to weather the storm, and they radiated out, meaning they turned into a bunch of different new species in the millions of years that ensued. And all the animals you see today are descended from a very, very small group of survivors.
And because they could fly, mm-hmm. they crossed rivers and oceans and whatever, right?
Yeah.
Continents.
Yeah.
They could spread around. And it's just one species of dinosaur that all these birds come from, do you think? Or
it might be, I mean, fundamentally, like, if we go far enough back, yes, it's one species of dinosaur. One skeleton that people are interested in as kind of like a really old bird ancestor is called Archaeopteryx.
Okay.
It looks kind of bird-like, but it's got teeth. It's still got teeth on its in its mouth, and it sort of has this proto bird look to it. You know, dinosaurs are all thought to have had feathers, just like birds, but feathers actually probably served a purpose other than flight when they initially evolved.
Okay, protection of some sort.
Yeah, it could have been, you know, keeping yourself warm, keeping yourself protected, signaling to mates, you know, having really bright, flashy plumage. And dinosaurs were like birds, what we call lukewarm-blooded or something like that. Basically, they can heat themselves, but they heat just by shivering. They vibrate their muscles until they generate enough heat to stay warm.
Oh, interesting.
Mammals are our group. Right. We have a special kind of fat that we burn to kind of constantly keep us going, but birds have to shiver just like dinosaurs did.
I've never seen a bird shiver.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I'll
have to look for it. Mm-hmm. The birds I know that are fairly common in our backyard are the blue jays.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very aggressive.
Oh, yeah.
And we love feeding them peanuts. Mm-hmm. And one time we kept a jar inside the house, and the blue jays knew where we kept them. And mm-hmm. if we had the door open, they'd actually fly in the house and get them.
Yeah.
What do you think about feeding birds or animals?
Well, I think the answer is nuanced. I think when it comes to birds, you know, I mean, one of the areas that I've kind of researched is urban ecology, basically studying how animals, you know, live in human spaces.
Right.
And for those kinds of animals, they are so, many of them are so adapted to looking for human resources.
Oh.
In fact, you know, one of the species I read about is called the house sparrow. It has lived with humans ever since kind of the dawn of agriculture, some, you know, 10,000 years ago.
Right.
And they are so well suited to living with humans, they've actually evolved the ability to digest starch, which is something that most birds can't do. But they can actually, so you shouldn't feed ducks bread because it's bad for them. They can't digest it.
Right.
House sparrows can, after thousands of years of evolving in proximity to people.
Wow.
And so the scrub jays also really, really good at figuring out where we put our food.
Yeah, of course.
So my answer to your question is you can put out a bird feeder.
Yeah, we
but
do.
Don't go into, you know, a national park or something and start feeding the animals.
Right,
if it's in your neighborhood, if it's in your city, that's fine.
Well, we have a war going on in our backyard between the birds and the squirrels that are always getting into the food.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And recently, Jeannie just bought a little thing you stick to the to the window and put seed in there so we can watch the birds, you know, sitting.
Yeah.
I'm sitting here. The birds are eating there. So that's kind of fun.
Yeah. No, that's great.
Okay. We're talking birds. We're talking animals. We're talking with Jacob Johnson, who just wrote a book. And are there any stories in there that are kind of unique or funny or anything like that that people might be interested to? I'm trying to get to a little hook that people might say, I want to read this book. You see?
I think there's – I try to use a lot of humor throughout the book.
Okay.
I'm a big fan of finding kind of funny ways to phrase things in okay. science. And I think a lot of the you know, a lot of the ways that animals interact with their world, especially with humans, are inherently right. funny. Usually humans end up being the ones who get – or often they end up getting duped by two clever animals figuring out ways to, you know, exploit our resources. And that right. always makes me really happy. Yeah. So yeah. Anyway, I have some stories in this
okay.
book that are
– do you want to read one? Can you get to one
Let's
quickly
see
or
if
not?
I can – can find one here.
You go for it. I'm going to just while you're doing that.
Yeah.
I'll just play a little tune, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Let's do this one.
Too many birds in one tree. Too many birds in one tree. And the sky is full of black and screaming leaves. The sky is full. Black and screaming, and one more bird, then one more bird, and one last bird, and another, one last blackbird without a place to land, one last blackbird without a place to be. Turns around in hopes to find the place at last knew rest. Oh, blackbird over black rain burn. This is not.
What a great song, Too Many Birds by Bill Callahan. Sometimes I wish we were an eagle. We're going to fade this out, but I'm going to have to play this sometime on a show that I only do music on, so everybody can get the chance to listen to it. Or look for it yourself, Bill Callahan, Too Many Birds. You know, right before my show... we have Audio Ecotone that is headed up by Eddie Out. And, you know, that this is one of the programs I'd love to listen to because he mixes up the music. A longtime explorer of diverse musical genres, Eddie Out is full-time geographer, part-time gardener, semi-retired musician, and a fearless dilettante of never far from a pithy quip. That is Eddie Out. Can you believe it? And right after my show, we have a new show, and that is called Next Gen Talks. And Jasmine comes in, and talks to interesting people from and around our local town of Davis. Young lady that is just starting out. I listened to her show last week. It was wonderful. And also next Wednesday, Suds and Sounds at Armadillo Music. We're going to have the DJs there again from KDRT from 4 to 6. We invite all of you to come out. We'll play some tunes. If you want, you can even select one of the albums in their collection, and they'll play it for you as long as it's not opened. And right now you're listening to KDRT 95.7 in Davis, California. I'm sitting here with Jacob Johnson, a PhD candidate for animal behavior. He's just written a book, and he's going to just share a little tidbit of that book to show us that this is something that all of us could read and learn from and coexist with the animal world so much around us.
All right. Here's a little abridged passage from this chapter is called The Cause, C-A-W-S, of Culture. Sticking too close to our primate cousins can lead us to miss some important details about social animals. Animals are behaviorally diverse, but we still see some patterns of behavior across species that are hundreds of millions of years of evolutionary divergence apart. Enter my favorite vertebrates, birds. Birds are the descendants of dinosaurs. The Costco $4.99 rotisserie chicken lies in the same taxonomic clade as the tyrannical T-Rex. Despite their evolutionary distance from humans, birds like parrots or corvids are fiercely intelligent. I could, and often do, go on and on about how brilliant birds can be, how some create and modify their own tools, how they build dazzling and aesthetically pleasing structures, how they dance to human music, invent their own sexy dance routines, and so on. It turns out that corvids don't just compare with humans in our ability to use tools and grasp the laws of physics. They may also exhibit something we long thought unique to ourselves. Culture. In the early 2000s, at the University of Washington, a scientist named John Marsluff and his team conducted an experiment involving crows and masks, testing whether crows could tell one human face from another. They used two different types of masks for the experiment. One mask was of a caveman's face, and the other was then Vice President Dick Cheney. When researchers wore the Dick Cheney masks, they left the crows alone. When they wore the caveman masks, though, they captured some of the crows and took their measurements. Crows loathe being handled against their will. Their captors were doubtlessly met with bouts of indignant caws and attempted bites. It wasn't long before the researchers saw a corresponding change in the crows' behavior. Whenever a researcher walked by wearing the Dick Cheney mask, the crows didn't mind, even if the liberal college students did. Whenever a researcher wore the caveman mask, the crows went ballistic. Researchers in caveman masks were often scolded and occasionally dive-bombed, a classic anti-predator behavior in many bird species. There was no doubt about it. The crows recognized human faces and changed their behavior depending on whose face it was. It gets stranger. Word of the caveman researchers and their nasty habit of putting crows in cages got around in avian social circles. In fact, 5 years after the initial experiments had ceased, the caveman mask scolding behavior had spread to crows across a 25-mile radius of the University of Washington campus, where the experiments had first taken place. Crows that weren't even alive when the experiments happened were still scolding anyone in a caveman mask. The campus crows had started a ritual that lived on after them. How is that possible? Crows don't talk to each other, per se. They weren't able to add caveman-looking people to their list of unholy humans in the Crow Testament. Instead, the crows learned by observing the behavior of their fellow crows. See your family and friends screaming at people in caveman masks, and you learn to associate those masks with danger. If you're a crow, even if you haven't experienced the danger yourself, you can still be conditioned to respond. This is socially acquired fear. From an evolutionary standpoint, it's an ingenious adaptation. In order to establish a threat response, many animals either have to go head-to-head with danger, or else evolve an inherent, naturally selected repulsion to certain organisms or natural formations. The crows from Marsluff's experiment showed a learned behavior that was repeated, spread, and passed down to a succeeding generation. We can see the resemblance to humans. The Seattle crows were exhibiting something like culture, maybe even a tradition. Wow. Most of the world's smartest animals share some traits. They're usually highly social, exhibit some form of tool use, and employ complex systems of communication. They are also often generalists, hunting and foraging for a variety of different foods. Even though high-powered bird brains evolved separately from high-powered mammal brains, corvids and parrots exhibit a tremendous amount of behavioral overlap with primates and whales, the two smartest families of the mammal world. A more high-powered brain allows animals to adapt their tactics at a rapid pace, much faster than the speed of evolution. Clever organisms use culture as a way to learn and teach about the world around them and to change in response.
Wow.
There you go.
You know, I'm just thinking here how this could apply. For instance, in a family grouping, if you have an abusive father, right, that is ingrained in the children and even the spouse. That could spread within a society that certain type of men, in this case, do certain things that are not appropriate, and you become afraid of certain people. I don't know. I'm just trying to think out of the box here a little, but...
Yeah. Yeah, you know, my grandma was a social worker in Detroit, and she would say, "We do unto others as we have had done unto ourselves."
Okay.
And so certainly you can have, you know, I mean, a lot of socially acquired fear in humans can come from, you know, a really bad place. That's true, too.
And that's exactly your example. A face mask of a Neanderthal or whoever it was evoked fear.
Right.
Amongst those crows.
Right.
So, yes, okay, so they know what I look like, so I have to be careful.
Right. No, they'll remember if you're nice or naughty to them.
Could you do something for me here and read a little PSA? It's right up your alley.
All right, let's see here. Right. This is for Friends of Yolo County Animal Services.
Okay.
Friends of Yolo County Animal Services supports adoptions for shelter animals, offers humane education programs, and provides information on low-cost veterinary care, pet food pantries, and lost and found animals. To learn about adoption opportunities, foster a pet in need, volunteer, or offer your support, visit friendsofycas.org.
Perfect. Do you have a pet?
I don't. I used
to
have a lizard named Henry T. Lizard.
Ooh, okay.
The T stood for the.
Oh, I have a cat, and every night when I go to bed, the cat will jump on my chest and just sit there, and we talk.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it doesn't matter what I talk about, but he just sits there and stares at you. And then he lays down, and I have to put a sheet right up to me because he just keeps going with his paw until he finds skin. And then he's happy. He just has his claws on me. You know? And then if I'm saying something really nice, he'll dig in and, oh. But anyway, so yes, I communicate with animals.
Yes, you do. And so, most of us do on a regular basis, whether we are, you know, deliberately doing that or not.
Right. And I've seen videos of elephants that have been away from someone who raised them for years, and they show up again, and the elephant goes nuts.
Yeah.
Along with the human.
Yeah, it's
extraordinary. Everybody's happy.
Yeah.
All righty, my friend. We're almost at the end here. I want to thank you for coming in. Is there anything you want to say that I forgot to ask?
I don't think so. Just that, yeah, the book is coming out on February 11th. It'll be available largely online via Amazon.
Okay.
But there will also be opportunities, hopefully, to get it at some local bookstores. Keep an eye out for it. Are You There, God? It's Me, Darwin, coming out on February 11th.
And I'll put a link to it on this show's podcast and online so people can check it out. Can you pre-order them already on Amazon?
I'm not sure if you can pre-order them, but I will let you know
so
you can put on the podcast.
And we'll do it.
ASAP. Yeah.
Alrighty, well, I think we've covered it all. I'm going to go out with a song that was inspired by the humpback whale.
Excellent.
And those animals, I mean, those are in, you could have a whole hour just talking about whale talk, right?
Love whales.
Yeah. Unbelievable. But anyways, it's not uncommon that we use whale sounds in some of our own music. So here is Humpback Whale Sounds, and I'm not going to put it to music because it's music to my ears the way it is. Thank you all for listening. You've been listening to KDRT 95.7 in Davis, California. I'm your host, Peter Pasteur, and we've interviewed Jacob Johnson here, a PhD candidate for animal behavior at the UC Davis University. Thanks all for listening. Bye now.